The programme uses the convention and manner of factual television to create a world where the idiotic is entirely plausible. The absolute authority of its presentation produces television comedy which relies not on jokes, you'd hope there were some jokes in there, but on the authentication of the ridiculous.
The Bank of England is in chaos following the discovery that the pound has been stolen.
As the news broke, trading rooms were plunged into chaos.
What's happening?
Even seasoned campaigners, known for grace under pressure, reduced to squawking the day's panicked cry.
What's happening?
What's happening?
We both had a sense that the news needed a bit of a kicking. It was entering the 90s, just had the first Gulf War. If it bleeds, it leads was the kind of catchphrase of the time.
The two reporters, along with CNN correspondent Peter Arnett, together witnessed the deadly but sometimes fantastic Allied attack on Baghdad.
And it was catching on here. People, newsreaders here, spoke about speaking with the voice of God. There was even little things, like just the way they said news. News.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 19th of September 2025. Streaming from a corner of freedom close by the Bristol city centre, don't believe a word we say. We do try to share moments of clarity from Bristol's Templar Port, the merchant venturer's fiefdom in the City of London's Masonic Empire of Lies. Lots about this kind of thing this week. The livery companies from medieval times, one of which was the Freemasons. Also these little orders of knighthood, you'll be hearing quite a lot about them, because it's funny, isn't it, as Donald Trump flies to Britain. Yes, well, I'm not even bothering looking at what he's saying with Starmer. The interesting bit, of course, is Windsor Castle. They say that apparently Buckingham Palace and various other places in central London are not available, one reason or another. Even in the city, they're not available. So they're doing it in Windsor. Windsor, of course, is the king's security people all around. So this is where the affairs of state are conducted nowadays, not anywhere near Downing Street. And the Downing Street is just some sense. Anyway, it's the cults. It's the Orders of the Garter. It's the merchant venturers in Bristol. And the rest of them. So anyway, we're not live, but we are on the talkradio.org.uk stream, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the app. Available free from APK Pure, Apple App Store, and from the website thisweek.org.uk. A little link there to GitHub, but not the evil Google Play. I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its accelerations, zero trust agendas, bending our minds with Orwellian BBC Verify, and boring us to tears with vacuous celebrities, puff pieces on the conspirators, hatchet jobs on the heroes, McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against the rentier class, World War III and wage slavery. The rentier and wage slavery, that's all it's all about, isn't it? Because rents have been jacked up. In fact, the basic things we need for life have been jacked up so much that actually we can't afford to live anymore. We need a little bit of disposable income, please. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to multiplying crises, housing, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, NHS, climate, twisted Armageddonist, accelerationist solutions, crafted to make every crisis worse. That's the kind of solution we don't need, thanks. Have the cabinet sold their souls to the devil because the politicians have nothing to say? Nick Land's Dark Enlightenment, social Darwinist control freaks and cowardly underlings want us as slaves to their AI or dead. Albert Pike's Zionist World War III plan is a big taboo, isn't it? Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie, living it up at Windsor Castle with Donald Trump and all his invited guests. Well, not very democratic, is it? No, not very democratic at all. And the vampire Queen Carmilla, Queen Consort, by the way, wage war on the British people as well as China, Russia and the BRICS. and anyone who's not their mates. The Crown prosecutes us for praying for unborn children, and the only right they want us to have is our so-called right to kill ourselves. Lovely people, here, have a knife. Go kill yourself. That's what they say. We're not going to. No, thank you very much. We don't really like your attitude. It's not very nice. With the help, like the jabs, of a doctor. Netanyahu is the king of chaos, rolling out a blood-red carpet for the Zionist man, God, Messiah, the Antichrist to come, which Adolf Hitler may have been the prototype for. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? So we'll be navigating the World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich, but not with good old Martin Summers this week. Again, we'll be back next week, Martin. And we'll be starting off this week, actually for a change, with Patrizia's poem, By Far Right the New Wrong. Since when was right so wrong, pray ask, a slur on those who take to task, prop billionaires who rue our world, where down is up and lies are hurled, accuse, abuse, their lies corrupt, as MSM delight in muck. Hate, no hope, report on side with billionaires devoid of pride, distorted truths, AI in reams, wars insane online have seen, confusion sore, no sense it made, flags torn up, inverted, staged, Maori actors seen outraged, Zionist hand overplayed. Tommy Puppet rallied round, hateful speech on Islam found, a Christian with Zionists he roots, confused poor Lenny in cahoots with IOF on genocide in Gaza, life to death deride. On stage the rage, confusion reigned, hate no hope, part of the game, delude, confuse, UK in reams, so many speakers devoid of dream, to stand on stage and speak their truth, disarray, part of the route, of route to route, all in cahoots. Is Israel the USA, and the USA Israel, pray? Don't beat about the bush, pray tell, why roads all lead to Israel? Thanks. Thanks, Patrizia. And we'll be talking about the Tommy Robinson rally on Saturday, Unite the Nation rally. But first, a few news stories from this week. St Nicholas Market here in Bristol, they're going to close it because they're trying to put the rents up so much that the small traders... So this is just the BlackRock agenda, the chaos agenda being rolled out here in Bristol. Rather irritating for the small businesses that are in St Nick's Market in the city centre. I do hope that they get organised against this. We've also got the guy at the Tommy Robinson rally who called for Keir Starmer's assassination. And amazingly, the Daily Mirror put his picture on the front page, but they pixelated it out. The police are hunting this guy for a threatening to kill the Prime Minister. But the Daily Mirror thinks you've got to pixel his face. Why? What are they playing at? This is a game, a little game they're playing. But anyway, this is part of the problem, is, of course, that incitement to murder, incitement to assassinate, the police aren't interested in those crimes, it seems. And they're cherry-picking, aren't they? Oh, well, that's this guy, we like him. He's a criminal. He's just out of jail. He's our friend. And he can say these things because we want to have this effect through the press. So I haven't heard whether he's been arrested or not. Also, it was the Tommy Robinson TV chat, is it Rebel News, I think it's called, that put this out. So these people who transmitted a death threat to the Prime Minister, is that free speech? Well, no, of course it's not. Incitement to kill somebody. In fact, any incitement to crime, it could be argued, is a crime. But certainly projecting a picture of Epstein up onto Windsor Castle is not a crime. But they were arrested, weren't they? What a funny old world we're living in. Because this is what Tampon Charlie likes. I did an interview with Adil Raja, which did very well, apparently, in Pakistan, which is all really in praise of Imran Khan. But he sent me something this week. He's a former soldier in the Pakistan Army, who's now a journalist in London, Adil Raja. We've had him on a couple of times. Commonwealth helped hide Pakistani election rigging. The military regime stole the 2024 elections from Imran Khan's PTI party using fraud and voter manipulation, a leaked report has found. So isn't that interesting? But the Commonwealth is involved in all of this. So this is the British, good old British MI6 connection. The Commonwealth has been accused of colluding with the Pakistani military to cover up widespread election rigging. So I'll put a link to that up on our show page. It's not the Russians rigging the American elections or any other elections, is it? It's the British trying to rig the US elections through the Steele dossier, and also trying to rig the Pakistani elections. MI6 seem to be at the heart of rather too much of the problems in the modern world. What are we going to do about them? Well, apparently there's not much you can do, because there's no scrutiny. They just do what they want, although they're paid by the public purse. Anyway, let's get into some of this week's. As I promised, we're going to be looking at the Tommy Robinson Unite the Nation rally. Who better to ask about that? Who better to hear? We've got 20 minutes of it on here about so-called freedom of speech from good old Heiko Koo, who I think in this clip he actually says that he's been 40 years he's been doing Speaker's Corner on a Sunday. So he's one of the best people to ask. So here's Heiko talking about free speech, Tommy Robinson, and the fatal flaws already emerging in Jeremy Corbyn's little party.
The topic today, because of the events of the last week, I thought should probably be around free speech, and I can give you what I know about it from my own experience at Speaker's Corner, which is quite extensive. I've been speaking here since 1985. This December, I'll have been here for 40 years. So the best part of my life, two-thirds of my life, I've been speaking here at Speaker's Corner. And times have changed. We've got electronic communication, we've got video cameras, streaming, all this sort of thing that we didn't have back in the day. But otherwise, the fundamental questions about free speech remain, and I think have been reflected in what happens at Speaker's Corner. We have people from different points of view, a Christian, a Muslim, a Marxist, a conservative, gays and lesbians, anti-gays and lesbians. We've had the lot at Speaker's Corner. Pro-trans activists, anti-trans activists, you name it, we've had it. And that, for me, represents free speech. And to be honest with you, most of the speakers here who've been here over the decades, I've got to know in one way or another. I used to do a radio show, interview with them, talk to them, discuss with them. And although they'll hold views that sharply contradict my own, many of them, we will get along generally okay. Pretty much every one of the speakers here who's been here over the last 30 years or so, I've interviewed, discussed with, debated with in one way or another. And even if they have the most hostile views, I'm prepared to interview them, discuss with them, debate with them. And for me, that in essence is what free speech is about. It's about a tolerance of the right of your political opponent, your ideological opponent, your religious opponent, your philosophical opponent, your scientific opponent to engage in discussion and debate around the ideas that they hold dear. And people change their mind. I've changed my mind over the years. Many of the speakers here have changed their minds over the years. There is no fixed formation. You're not born to be, in my opinion, of a Muslim belief or Christian belief or Marxist belief or socialist belief or Tory belief. These ideas are forged during your lifetime. And therefore, they have some flexibility about them. They adjust and amend and change over the years. Now, yesterday I attended the event which Tommy Robinson organised in central London. I wanted to go along to both the Tommy Robinson event to identify the type of character, people, beliefs that people were there for, and I also wanted to go along to the counter protest. I didn't manage to make it to that, because when I got there was a row of police blocking access to them, and there are a lot of Tommy Robinson supporters pressing up against the police lines, and therefore it wasn't possible. Firstly, on that question, I would wonder why it is the police agreed to have two counterposed demonstrations on such sharply conflictual issues in Whitehall itself. I find that a little bit odd, given the fact that only a month or 2 months ago there was a Palestine demonstration that was forbidden from going marching to the BBC and was restricted to remaining inside Whitehall, and they weren't able to march anywhere without getting arrested, and Piers Corbyn, who we know quite well, was arrested for going to the BBC at that time and presenting a bunch of flowers. And so I can't see why it is that the police would have authorised, and the Home Office and the authorities authorised, two demonstrations which were directly in conflict with each other on such sharply divided political opinions to gather in the same street. I find it most odd. And there was, of course, some conflict which broke out afterwards. The newspapers and television stations and radio stations have reported an estimated 100,000, then they changed it to 150,000. My own belief is there was something between perhaps 300,000 and 500,000 people there. It was an extremely large demonstration on behalf of Tommy Robinson and co. Extremely large demonstration. And it reflects a genuine mood with amongst certain sections of the population who are angry at migration. Now, migration, I looked at the statistics this morning, and the peculiarity is, when you look at the data on migration in the last 10 years, the biggest spike in migration followed Brexit. Now, it's quite peculiar because Brexit was clearly an issue where the population were, or the majority who voted in favour of Brexit, 52 to 48, whatever the statistic was, were clearly hostile to free movement and migration inside the European Union. And yet, after Brexit, there was this giant spike in the amount of people who migrated into Britain. And so I find that a little bit odd. Some people put conspiracies behind that. I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case, but it certainly is peculiar that the main spike in migration took place after Brexit, in particular after the coronavirus events. Now, there are those who say that they're in favour of open borders, and I've always been, in theory, in favour of open borders, but at the same time, see, there is no country in the world that has completely open borders, and those countries that do have open borders, for example, for tourism, at least tourism to the extent that a huge numbers of people will go on holiday to certain locations at particular times of the year and cause enormous strain on the resources of those countries, for example, certain parts of Spain, some parts of Greece, and other holiday destinations are flooded with people at certain times of the year, and it takes resources from the local population, makes the local population homeless and suffer from economic dislocation as a consequence of that. And that's why there have been protests in Italy, in Portugal, in Spain, and other and Greece about mass migration in the name of tourism. In other words, temporary migration, which takes resources from the population. And I think, in essence, the concern about the people coming on boats to Britain has a similar type of foundation. It's the resources available to the population. You'll hear people, and I heard people yesterday, people are coming over here and they're getting their homes before we get them. The council housing's not available. Public resources are being given to migrants who come over here on boats without documentation. They might be criminals, etc., etc. That's the primary narrative around the protests at the hotels and the specific provocation for the scale of the events which happened yesterday. Then there's the question about this guy Charlie Kirk, who was killed in the United States last week speaking at Utah Valley University. Now, I do not agree with those people on the left who have taken a position. Well, he argued that having guns in society inevitably has a certain cost, and therefore he's a victim of that. I think free speech means you must be able to tolerate the views of people who are opposed to you. And that, as I said, is why at Speaker's Corner I've always advocated and defended free speech, even of those who I disagree with. So, for example, when the Posey Parker came up here to oppose trans rights, or better said, to support women's rights over trans rights, and was attacked by a number of activists who call themselves trans activists or trans anarchist activists, when she was attacked by them, I stood in between and tried to prevent them from violently stopping the meeting. When Nick Ticconi, who's the leader of UKIP and is the representative of Turning Point UK, the same organisation that Charlie Kirk is a member of, when he came to an event called Marxism, I think it was Marxism 2022, and he had an amplifier, and he spoke there challenging the people at that conference or that political meeting or that educational meeting to debate him, I went over and debated him. I'm not afraid of debating people who have a different point of view to me, even if it's completely the opposite side. And he was debating. Now, you might argue he's a Nazi, a fascist or whatever, but he was debating, and as long as he was debating and he had about 10 of his people around him, I'm happy to debate. And unfortunately, some people from that political meeting came over and stormed against them and started a violent clash with them. And I tried to oppose them and said to them, calm it down, engage in debate, what's the matter with you? Because democratic discussion, if you can't win a democratic discussion and debate, or you're not prepared to engage in that democratic discussion and debate, I think you're wasting your time. You're never going to be able to win people over. I was at a meeting of the new party created, or the founding groups of the new party called yourparty.uk, which was founded by Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana. I went to their meeting on Friday night. In Brixton. There were about 1,000 people there. I was quite pleased with the audience, with a lot of young people, and so on. But Zara Sultana turned around and said, anybody who's socially conservative or has socially conservative views, in other words, doesn't agree that a man who dresses as a woman and declares himself to be a woman is a woman, then they're not welcome in this party. And I was disgusted by that, particularly because she made the point 3 or 4 times during that meeting, and she only mentioned class, I think, once. And so if you're going to talk about a socialist movement, I think you need to be clear that if you're going to have large-scale involvement by the working classes in such a movement, which if you've got, as they have, 750,000 or 800,000 people have signed up, then clearly you're going to have people of different views on issues like that, which are highly contentious issues, about biology, about the position of women, about the position of sexuality, about the position of the law. All these questions are big issues about sport and all the rest of it, which you can't simply resolve by declaring some posture that we stand for this and you're not allowed. That means Christians, there's a lot of devout Christians who follow the Bible. They don't agree. A lot of them don't agree, aren't liberal Christians, in the social sense, in the liberal sense, and therefore they won't support the idea of, self-identification of someone as a woman. They won't support the pronoun campaign. They won't support the issue of trans rights as elevated above women's rights, which I think is what has been happening. That's what my view is, it's been happening. Now, I have people who are trans, I know. I don't have any problem whatsoever with those people. I just don't think that their rights should be elevated above the rights of a woman. And that, I had debates with people. I used to think this was a sideline issue. I don't know why people are going on about it. But when I heard the people coming up here, some of whom I knew for many years ago as socialist activists in the labour movement, were participating in the meetings here, defending what they said was women's rights against the encroachment of their rights by the trans movement. I came round to their point of view and I agree with their point of view. But I could only have done that by debate and discussion. You can't come round, can't get people on your side by simply declaring, we are right and you are wrong. And how do they do that? Another example of that is the issue about climate change. Now, I've been friends with Piers Corbyn for many years. I used to assume that the arguments about climate change, about CO2, man-made industrialization and pollution, are correct. I used to assume that. I didn't know about it. I assumed it because it was the type of position that I felt an affinity towards. Protecting the environment, protecting nature, stopping its destruction, and could there be generic consequences which are undermining the whole of humanity? I thought naturally that that was something that I had an affinity with. I discussed with Piers over the years. I wasn't convinced by his point of view, but I did interviews with him. I debated with him. I believe, and then I followed the wider debate internationally taking place around these issues. And I began to be less persuaded by their arguments. And I certainly thought there is no room for the prohibition of argument about those questions, about the impact of certain gases on the fate of the entire climatic system of the planet. And I think that question is an open question that has not been resolved. Now, some people say it's been resolved, there is no impact. I don't know, maybe there is some impact, but I don't believe that anything that we do in Britain will make the slightest difference apart from the sense of saying, I'm going to wear a badge, don't do this. You know, it's virtue signalling. There is nothing that Britain can do, even if the entire population of Britain only ate grass for 50 years, it would not make the slightest difference if the calculations of the CO2 is a dangerous threat to humanity through climate change, if that were all true, if the very worst case scenarios that they present were true, if the whole population of Britain stopped eating and stopped using gas, electricity and everything, it would still make no difference whatsoever to what happens to the planet. That's a simple fact. And therefore it is a signal. They are saying that if you signal this, the whole of the world might copy you. That's a utopian idea, because interests stand behind the utilization of resources. And you can see that this is virtue signaling, because the very same corporations, Mark Zuckerberg's Meta, Google and so on, all of whom a couple of years ago were hysterically waving the flag for climate change, net zero company and all the rest of it, they are now spending trillions of dollars on data centers for AI, where they're not making any money out of it, consuming enormous amounts of electricity, enormous amounts of technological resources that if they wanted to, could be used to save the climate crisis. But instead of this, according to their own criteria, they're spending vast amounts on profit-seeking activities or on attempts to create profit-seeking activities to reach AGI as a consequence of their expenditure on artificial intelligence. So it is entirely falsification to say that these entities who have been promoting these ideas amongst the population, that they are telling the truth. They are not telling the truth. No. And they never have been.
Yes.
Now, and therefore what we do, the grassroots person, I mean, I remember when I first, as I said, when I first encountered this issue really seriously, it was around the Extinction Rebellion campaign, because they came to Speaker's Corner to Marble Arch. I think it was 2018. Suddenly there were like several camps of them in central London. And I was looking at it, what a weird demonstration. Suddenly, the whole of central London was blocked by six different encampments. They all had strange flags with this egg timer on it. And they all had certain ways of behaving, orchestrated by a group that ran the network. Just one sec. And this group, it turned out, was directly linked to some major corporate players. Paul Polman from Unilever, and Mark Carney, now Prime Minister of Canada, who was then the former governor of the Bank of England. And they were about to launch, the same time they launched Extinction Rebellion, they launched something called Business Rebellion. A business rebellion was led by them. But then because there was a little bit of kickback against that, because the followers of their campaign were a lot of young people who were trying to protect the planet and a bit hostile to the role of big business, they withdrew this and hid it. But I think there was a genuine global campaign by some corporations to elevate this Extinction Rebellion into a sort of a political arm of their own corporate green interests. And that's got nothing to do with the validity or unvalidity or invalidity of the arguments about climate change.
So that's Heiko Koo there. HEIKOKHOO. On free speech, Tommy Robinson and your party and Zara Sultan seems to be already making it impossible for the majority of the population to join the party. It's not very clever, Zara. Yeah, you're making a mess of it all. Maybe on purpose, hey? That's most likely. Also, on the march, I just thought, you know, one of the reasons a lot of people went on to this march is because Britain is in such a mess. And part of the reason is we've got these idiot ministers reading out nonsense speeches about very basic stuff that we're not allowed to do in order to try and destroy the country. So here's one, Mary Criach. I think she's the Nature Minister. I didn't know we had a Nature Minister, but apparently we do. And apparently the government is now banning something which people have been doing for centuries, probably thousands of years. Certainly in Ireland, when I was over there in the 1990s, people were still heating their homes by burning peat. But you're not allowed to anymore, according to Mary Criach. This is a great policy. They've got another accelerationist policy, of course.
On Tuesday, we extended the ban on burning deep peat. Our peatlands store more carbon than all our forests combined. Our peatlands are our Amazon rainforest. They are simply too big to fail. This ban will shield local communities from flooding, improve the air that they breathe, and crucially protect wildlife, upland wildlife, from burning.
That was the potty Mary Criach. I don't know how you pronounce that, talking about the government is about to ban the burning of peat. So anyway, Donald Trump's in town, isn't he? And the state banquet. I did say something at the start about these cults, these little cults that they have for status. People love being told, yes, you've got a special badge, you're in this organisation. They swear an oath to the group, the organisation of secrecy. And they can, yeah, they do actually. Even in the old guilds, they do that. But it's a sort of witchcraft style thing. You know, I'm not saying they are, but it's the same sort of thing that these satanic cults and all sorts of cults do: swear oaths of secrecy. It's called the oath crime in the Orthodox Church, which is Jesus's Sermon on the Mount, where he says, "Never swear an oath." Simply let your yes be yes and your no be no. Anything else comes from the devil. So it's pretty clear. You shouldn't be doing the oaths that you swear when you join these various little organisations. Now, introducing is Alastair Bruce from Sky News. Alastair happens to be a general in the British Army. I think he's a reserve general. But isn't it interesting that King Charles is so powerful that he can force or persuade Sky News to use an army general to introduce him. And also, of course, he's an insider, and of course he's not batting for us, he's batting for the king on Sky. I suppose Sky think they're doing really well having him there. But anyway, this I think, and I honestly thought King Charles's speech was so dull. I've not got any of it, but we have got a bit here of Donald Trump's speech at the big state banquet, which to me was the big event. I mean, whatever else Trump is up to with Starmer, it doesn't really matter. It's what's going on with the head of state that really counts. And of course, King Charles is famously leading from the front. He's not the one to sit behind and let the politicians get on with it. He wants to be in charge.
There'll be a joke about America's independence, probably, for orphanage.
That's Clive Alderton, who is the King's private secretary.
Right. Alistair Bruce is joining us. I think Alistair Bruce is now joining us, who will be commentating on the event in due course. But, Alistair, just first of all, your thoughts. I mean, and what a... Tell us about the room. Incredibly grand.
Yes, it is, and the fact that it was put together originally as a structure by King Edward III in the 14th century to be a place to celebrate the Order of the Garter that had been created in 1348 gives some sense of the history and the coats of arms, the original Knights of the Garter around the side. And
back to a man who knows all about these things, Alistair Bruce. Alistair, take it away.
Coming from the grand reception room into the Waterloo Chamber is the royal procession, and led on the left by the Lord Chamberlain, and on the right by the Lord Steward, Lord Bennion, and Lord Rosslyn. The Prince of Wales is with Miss Paula Reynolds, Chair of National Grid, the Duke of Gloucester with Mrs. Laurie Huang. Her husband is the CEO of NVIDIA, a tech company. Prince of Wales. He's wearing a Windsor coat, which is a white tie jacket, which has red cuffs and red collar, which members of the royal family always wear at Windsor, and which has been a tradition going since Georgian times. And once everyone's sat down, the King will indicate that he is ready to welcome the President of the United States. The centrepiece there of St. George killing the dragon at the centre of this table. A reminder of the tradition of the Order of the Garter, for which St. George is the symbol that is so much evident in this hall.
For many decades, His Majesty the King has epitomized the fortitude, nobility, and the spirit of the British monarchy and the British people. He's dedicated himself to preserving the glory and unique character of this kingdom, restoring life to the rivers and streams, supporting the works of its artists and composers, planting trees and gardens in its countryside. And I just visited one of the most beautiful I've ever seen that you just completed, and protecting the architectural integrity of cities, villages, and towns. He has uplifted the poor, cared for rural farmers, and tended to wounded veterans like nobody else. I'll tell you that I just stood in line and shook about 150 hands, and the King knew every single person and every single company, and some of them had bad names like XYZ-Q3, and he knew every one of them, or at least I think he did, because nobody was complaining. I was very impressed with that. But I just want to say that His Majesty has also raised a remarkable son, and His Royal Highness, Prince of Wales. Amazing. We've gotten to know you, and I think you're going to have an unbelievable success in the future. Melania and I are delighted to visit again with Prince William and to see Her Royal Highness, Princess Catherine, so radiant and so healthy, so beautiful. It's really a great honor. Thank you. Many years ago, His Majesty opened his archives to a biographer. Among the documents was a letter from 1993 in which he described the patriotism and guided his many projects. He wrote that he was, quote, entirely motivated by a desperate desire to put the great back into Great Britain. In the finest tradition of British sovereigns, he's given his whole heart, everything he's got, to those parts of Britain that are beyond the realm of mere legislation. It's not easy, but which define its essence and its virtue, its harmony and its soul. It's an amazing calling, and there's nobody that's answered that calling like you have. A fifth of all of humanity speaks, writes, thinks, and praise, and the language born on these isles, and perfected in the pages of Shakespeare and Dickens and Tolkien, Lewis, Orwell, and Kipling. Incredible people, unbelievable people like we have rarely seen before, probably won't see again. The lion-hearted people of this kingdom defeated Napoleon, unleashed the Industrial Revolution, destroyed slavery, and defended civilization in the darkest days of fascism and communism. The British gave the world the Magna Carta, the modern parliament, and Francis Bacon's scientific method. They gave us the works of Locke and Hobbes, Smith and Burke, Newton and Blackstone. The legal, intellectual, cultural, and political traditions of this kingdom have been among the highest achievements of mankind. There's really never been anything like it. The British Empire laid the foundations of law, liberty, free speech, and individual rights virtually everywhere the Union Jack has ever flown, including a place called America. You know that place very well, don't you? His Majesty spoke eloquently about the bond which inspired Sir Winston Churchill, and the bust is in the Oval Office right now, the beautiful bust of Winston Churchill, to coin the phrase special relationship. But seen from American eyes, the word special does not begin to do it justice. We're joined by history and fate, and by love and language, and by transcendent ties of culture, tradition, ancestry, and destiny. We're like two notes in one chord, or two verses of the same poem, each beautiful on its own, but really meant to be played together. The bond of kinship and identity between America and the United Kingdom is priceless and eternal. It's irreplaceable and unbreakable, and we are, as a country, as you know, doing unbelievably well. We had a very sick country 1 year ago, and today, I believe we're the hottest country anywhere in the world. In fact, nobody's even questioning it, but we owe so much of that to you and the footing that you gave us when we started.
So that's a state banquet recording with Alastair Bruce reporting, Sky News' Army General, even though they don't tell you that on there, they should do, of course, giving you an introduction and Donald Trump giving his. So it's nice to hear Tolkien mentioned. Tolkien wrote an allegory about the end of the world where he talks about the Illuminati. That's Sauron in the eye in the pyramid, or the eye in the top of the tower. And Saruman, who's the mason, the one with the white hand, which is one of those little nice little gloves all the Freemasons wear. So he's brilliant, Tolkien. He was a translator of the Bible, the Jerusalem Bible. I think he translated one book of it. But he was also a Roman Catholic, bit of a genius, really. So that's Donald Trump. He's now here. And what about the Tommy Robinson rally? Well, lots to say about that, particularly the Maoris and the Christian Zionist Maoris that weren't really Maoris. Most of them aren't Maoris, but they're Christian Zionists from, very controversial, from Auckland. And so that's why they're there, because they're pro-Israel. So you don't need to be a genius to work out why our ex-MP Andrew Bridgen wasn't given time to speak. He went to the rally, as did several others. A Canadian guy flew over from Canada, but they said to him, sorry, not enough chance, because he wasn't pro-Israel enough, I guess. Anyway, here's Andrew Bridgen saying what he would have said if Tommy Robinson Brigade had kept their promise and let him speak at the rally on Saturday.
This is part of the speech I was going to give on Saturday at the Freedom of Speech Festival. That freedom of speech is the most important freedom, because there is no freedom at all without freedom of speech. And to have freedom of speech, you need freedom of thought. And to have freedom of thought, you need freedom of information. So we must push back against any censorship and restrictions. A true leader lays out a shared vision of the future and asks the people to come with him or her and make that vision a reality. A false leader makes promises which they know they can't keep. They cannot lead the people because the people will not follow them. So therefore they have to try and control the people instead. What sort of leaders do you think we have in our country at the moment? These false leaders need to get us into a war, a big war, a war to cover up the lies they've told to you, the money they've stolen from you, and the crimes they've committed against you. We must resist the pull to a war which will bury the poor and make the rich even more wealthy. And if we get involved in the control measures of digital ID, if we say yes to digital ID, I fear we'll never be able to say no to the government ever again. Stay strong, stay united, stand together. And the darker it gets, remember, the nearer we are to the end. Thank you very much for listening to me.
So that's Andrew Bridgen MP saying what he would have said if he had been given a chance to speak. I think it was Clive Lewis MP wrote a brilliant piece about how many of the people are just patriotic, but they've got nobody to vote for. And what happens is Tommy Robinson tries to run the entire show. Many of the people, of course, that went to the rally, there were about 110,000 people there, even though Tommy claimed 3 million. Many of them are not interested in the racist side of things. But it's portrayed by the press that it's Tommy Robinson and the people on the stage that count. No, it isn't. Sorry, this is the way the press does things. So that's Andrew Bridgen, and of course he's famous for his speeches. We had him on a few weeks ago talking about them too, about COVID and the dangers of the vaccines. And so just to back all that up, here is Dr. John Campbell this week speaking about a survey that's been done into the COVID jabs. So looking at those, what was in the little files that were going into people's bodies, and discovering that they were massively contaminated with DNA. What is that DNA? Not mRNA, but DNA. What's that doing in there?
32 vials from 16 unique vaccine lots. So quite a good sample. And it's also tested vials from different parts of the world at different times. David's become a bit of a world-leading expert in this, to be quite honest. All products tested exceeded the guidelines for residual DNA set by the FDA and WHO of 10 nanograms per dose, and they were exceeded by 36 to 627 fold. So that's not a 36% increase, it's 36 times more than there should have been. Or others contained 627 times more DNA. Hundreds and hundreds of times more DNA than is allowed. And these allowances are already set way, way, way too low, in my opinion. 40 promoter enhancement, the original sequence. And of course, that works on P53. Now, what happens here is that this contamination, this DNA contamination contains the genetic code required to make the SV40 protein from the simian virus. SV40 DNA produces SV40 protein, and that SV40 protein inhibits our own P53 tumour or oncosuppressor genes, making cancer more likely. It's basically debilitating our body's own natural defence mechanisms, which is why it's so important. So there we are, DNA contamination confirmed. There should be a moratorium on these vaccines till this is sorted out for this reason alone. Unfortunately, no such moratorium is in place. This is good science, but it'll probably be ignored.
Dr. John Campbell there with a new survey which shows that the contamination levels of DNA in the COVID jabs were absolutely off the scale. I mean, shocking.
And also, of course, Robert Kennedy Jr., better news really from across the pond, is now in charge over there. So he spoke to the Brazilian interviewer. I don't quite know much about him, but he's called Vozes, V-O-Z-E-S-D-O-P-O-D-E-R, Podder, about COVID. Obviously, he's got to talk to him about that. US foreign policy as well, which is great to hear RFK's take on what the Americans are doing around the world, and also his faith.
One of the most frustrating parts about the pandemic response was the information chaos. We were not told the truth about things, and the information tabulating and collection and analytical systems were designed to fail. And so it's going to be hard ever really parsing out what caused disproportionate deaths in some countries. I'll say this, that the lower vaccinated countries in the world tended to have the lowest death tolls. And I'll give you an example. And again, you know, you don't know because of the information chaos and the different collection systems and data in different countries. But in Haiti, the death rate from COVID was about 14 people per million population. And Haiti had a vaccination rate of about 1.3%. Oh, very few people got vaccinated, and yet there does not seem to have been a COVID pandemic in Haiti. Nigeria had a death rate from COVID of 14 per million population. In our country, the death rate was over 3,000 people per million population. So we are 200 times the death rate of countries that were essentially unvaccinated.
America, 4.2% of the global population, right, suffered over 1.1 million COVID deaths, representing
about 16% of the COVID deaths.
That's it. 16%.
And we have, as you say, around 4% of the world's population. So we did worse than any country in the world. Brazil was close.
Right? We're talking about 12% of global COVID-19 deaths, while making up only 2.7% of the world's population. So similar, right?
Yeah.
But if and when, and God forbid it does, the world, and once again, we witness a similar pandemic or even a harsher one, how have you been actually implementing different protocols in order to prevent that looking forward and that catastrophic scenario we all want to avoid?
Well, I mean, I would say one of the main failures during COVID was the almost complete failure to explore therapeutic options and off-the-shelf options.
Yep.
And we had a real opportunity because of the existence of the internet. There's 15 million frontline physicians around the world, and we should have been talking to them. We should have been saying, what's working in your country? What's working in Bangladesh? What's working in Argentina? What's working in Brazil? And harvesting that data and then telling the world, these are things that people are trying that seem to be working. There were deliberate attacks against hydroxychloroquine at the beginning of the pandemic and then against ivermectin later on. And those are two therapeutic interventions that clearly worked very, very well against COVID. But there are many, many others. And all of them were systematically attacked because there was only one solution that we were allowed to consider, and that was vaccination. And so we were doing nothing to take care of sick people. And in our country, if you went to the hospital and you were maybe having a little trouble breathing, but you were symptomatic of COVID, and you got a positive COVID test, you were told by that hospital, there's nothing we can do with you. Go home till your lips turn blue. And you can't breathe at all. And then come back here and we'll put you on a ventilator, which is going to kill you. Or remdesivir, which is going to kill you. And this has never happened before. If you even go to a hospital with the flu, you're going to be treated somehow. But we were told, no, there's going to be no treatment. And then the lockdowns were irrational. You know, they were arresting surfers on the beaches in California and giving them $1,000 fines for being out on the water. Well, COVID didn't spread outdoors. COVID was spreading indoors. So they were taking people, forcing them indoors. where COVID would spread to the whole family. And so everything about it was not only wrong, but it was the inverse of everything that you would actually want to do if you wanted to prevent a pandemic. And you know, those kind of questions need to be asked. Why were we asking people to do things that, you know, were not in their or in the health interests of them or their or the country?
In terms of food safety policies, I mean, what would you say is the specific one you're the proudest of, or do you think is the most promising one that you've already implemented right now in order to finally change the much worrying tendencies and trends of sickening Americans?
Well, I mean, we're very early on in the administration, but we've already done more than any other administration in history. We have commitments from 40% of the food industry to eliminate the 9 synthetic petroleum-based dyes. And that's a huge achievement. But also, we are encouraging the states to apply for waivers to the food stamp program so that the federal taxpayer will not be paying for it. We spend, in our country, $405 million a day on food stamps. $405 million a day. And about 12% of that goes to buying sodas. So you're taking the poorest population and you're giving them sugar drinks that are going to cause diabetes. And so what we're asking the states to apply for waivers, and there's already been a half dozen states have done that, and we got 20 more that are in the process. And they're saying, okay, we're not going to pay for candy with taxpayer money to feed poor people. We're not going to pay for soda. And we're going to get rid of other foods that that are making people sicker, and we're going to make sure that people have an opportunity to buy good food for themselves and their children.
Hopefully Brazil will be able to mirror that to some extent. But Secretary Kennedy, if I might, the whole COVID crisis and the ensuing repercussions and ramifications.
You know, I'll say one other thing.
Please do.
Ultimately, the change, the dramatic switch, a transition in our food supply to healthy foods, it's going to have to come not just from government, but it's going to have to come from consumer demand. But we can help that. And, you know, I'll give you the example of France. In France, 1/3 of the population has downloaded the Yucca app. The Yucca app, which is available around the world, allows people to go into grocery stores and put their cell phones on the barcode for all the different products, and it gives those products a rating. And then it will also offer you an alternative that is healthier. And what happened in France is it's driven consumer demand for much safer products. And that ultimately is what's going to change the markets. It's if the consumers are saying, we don't want this anymore. And one of the things that, you know, my job is to inform consumers that this stuff is poisoning you and you better pay attention to it, and then helping giving them the tools. One of the things that we're doing in our country is we're right now making it your own healthcare records available to you on your cell phone. So everybody will be able to look at their healthcare records, and you'll be able to see whether certain things are certain changes in your life and interventions in your life and lifestyle changes and food changes are actually making you healthier. We need to put Americans in charge of their own health care and get them to stop relying on the government.
The automatic reaction to some is that it's kind of too expensive to have a healthy lifestyle, but considering these initiatives, definitely it has to be.
You it's have a the lot personal cheaper initiative. If you're healthy.
Exactly.
Precisely. You know, in our country in 1900, we spent, the average American spent 20% of their income on food and 5% on health care. Today, we spend 20% of our income on health care and only 8% on food. Well, we need to start recognizing that food is a medical intervention and that good food is going to be much cheaper in the long run than, you know, than the food that's inexpensive in your grocery store.
I mean, you hail from one of the most storied families in American life, the Kennedys. You're definitely the most relevant Kennedy in present day. You're the nephew to the 35th President, John F. Kennedy, the son to Robert Kennedy. President Kennedy used to have a great relationship based on mutual respect, not on charity and aid and submission, with President Kubitschek, who was responsible in the 1960s of building Brasilia, our current capital city. They were great partners back then. They actually started the Alliance for Progress in building economic development projects in Latin America. After your uncle's death, your father, Bobby Kennedy, then attorney general to your uncle, he visited the stilted palafitas of Salvador and the shanty settlements over there. There are just fantastic pictures from that moment. And the law school I attended, which is the Pontifical Catholic University of Rio de Janeiro, has a huge statuesque bronze bust of your uncle right in the center of our campus. So there's a long story and just very considerable connection between your family and our country.
Well, I'll just comment on what you said. My uncle had a deep affection for Latin America. And he and, you know, President Kubitschek and President Frei from Chile, President Betancourt from Venezuela, President Yeris Camargo from Colombia launched the Alliance for Progress. And they wanted to change the relationship into a partnership relationship, as you point out, with Latin America. And before that, U.S. policy had been based upon a very pragmatic consideration of, you know, who was going to be the most anti-communist, because we, you know, our stature and our posture in the world was that it was a battle between darkness and light, between democracy and communism. And so, and it made the United States very vulnerable, our foreign policy, to a foreign policy that said, if you are a military junta, if you're part of an oligarchy that hates communism because you don't want people to take your wealth, and we're going to support you. And we ended up supporting all the military dictatorships and the, you know, these oligarchical, really semi-feudal systems, which they had in your country. My father visited, by then I think President Goulart was,
the military movement in 1964.
Right. And you know, he, when my uncle died, President Johnson switched back to that old foreign policy.
Yep.
And he brought a guy in called Thomas Mann, who had relationships with the intelligence community and with the oil interests and mining interests in to run the Alliance for Progress. And my father was very upset about that, and he made that visit in 64, 65 to Brazil, to Peru, to Chile, to the other Latin American countries. And he said to them, you know, you are in charge of your own future. If you don't like Anaconda wire and cable running your country, or AT&T, you should have a revolution against them. And that shocked everybody, but it was something that he believed in, and that he believed that these nations should have sovereignty and that they should dictate their own future, and that would make a much stronger partnership with the United States.
Mr. Secretary, if we might delve a little bit into the personal side and political side of things, how about we just go for a brief stroll down recent memory lane, back to August 23rd, 2024, in Glendale, Arizona, when you endorsed President Trump, and that took many by surprise for sure. Could you walk us through behind the scenes of that day, and what did you actually consider, electorally speaking, the calculus that you made, and particularly, and I got to hand it to you, how the class act that you were from that point on, and even before that, but to this day, even against the backlash coming from many of your siblings and relatives?
I mean, you know, I did something that was unpopular with a lot of people who were lifelong friends and family, but it was something that I thought was best for our country. And, you know, I had started out in the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party basically changed the rules to make it so that there's no way that I could win. And I'll give you an example. They passed a rule because I had been campaigning in New Hampshire, which is the first state to have a primary. And so the Democratic Party passed a rule that said that anybody who sets foot into New Hampshire cannot get any delegates from New Hampshire. And they were doing that all along. They made it literally impossible. I could have won 80% of the vote, and I would have still lost the convention. And so that, you know, people had given their lives and had given huge amounts of money to my campaign.
And you almost made to that first debate. You almost hit the 15% mark, although the media pool, they clearly subverted the criteria in order to avoid your presence there. That would have been a first since 1996, right, with Ross Perot's second and final candidacy as an independent candidate, right?
Yeah.
Were you first frustrated about that? I'm sure you were.
I was, you know, what I was doing was making decisions based upon the world that was given to me.
Yep.
And the facts on the ground were what they were, that the media would not cover my campaign. And I'm not complaining about it. It was just a fact of life. So for me to accomplish my agenda as best I could,
you had to go for
the best strategy was to merge my campaign with President Trump's.
And when that happened, you just did an interview where you mentioned how you discovered a more empathetic side to President Trump. Other than that, your relationship with him spans many decades, but you've become closer and, of course, have this working relationship since February 23rd, if I'm not mistaken, when you were confirmed. Other than that, how have you been dealing with him, and what have you discovered about him that you didn't know before?
Well, I've spoken about my changing impression of President Trump. I accepted the mainstream media portrait of him as kind of a bombastic narcissist who didn't read books, who was ignorant of most affairs, who was impulsive. And, you know, I found somebody who's completely different than that, somebody who's extraordinarily empathetic, that he is, that he thinks about other people and the impacts. You know, I've spoken about the fact that every time he mentions the war in Ukraine, he mentions the casualties on both sides of the war. And whenever he talks about almost any issue of consequence, he talks about the impacts on human beings. So he cares about people. He's kind. It's in his personal relationships. He's been very, very kind to me, to my family, to my wife, to my children. And also, he's extraordinarily knowledgeable. And, you know,
he's a student of history, right?
He's a student of history. And, you know, anybody who saw his interview this week, where he went through the portraits in the Oval Office during the cabinet meeting and talked a little bit about each president, can show that, you know, can get a display of his curiosity and his knowledge. But he has encyclopedic knowledge about music, about sports, about UFC fighting and about boxing and about a lot of other issues. I was on an airplane with him at one point, and he was talking about the Mideast. And he put it, he asked for a piece of paper, and then he drew a map, a perfect map of the Mideast. He has a very good hand. And with all the nations and the troop strength in each nation, and that's something that I think does not fit into the public narrative about President Trump. He's very thoughtful. He's strategic in his thinking. And, you know, a lot of what he does may seem impulsive, but if you look at the long-term good of our country, it's not good to have a trade deficit of $1.2 trillion a year. It's existential, and we can't continue. And the tariffs, maybe people would say, well, you should have done it over a longer period of time, but you know, President Trump knows that he only has 4 years and that most of the things that he accomplishes are going to be in his first year. And so he's acting very, very fast. And this is true on all of these issues. He feels an urgency and he acts quickly and he acts decisively and he knows what he wants. And, you know, I respect that. I think he's looking at the long-term good of America, which very few politicians do.
So, Secretary Kennedy, I know life must seem overwhelming given the dynamics of politics and all of the horse trading, all of the pressures. But what keeps you grounded today in 2025? Is it still your faith, the outdoors? Is it your wife, Cheryl? Is it your six children, Bobby the Third, Kick, Connor, Kira, Finn, and Aiden? How would you, or all and of them, Kat, I guess, yeah. And Kat as well.
It's all those things. I mean, I try to live a balanced life, and I try to be centered when I approach life. I do meditations every morning. I do exercise every day, and I try to make sure that I'm, living in the higher vibrations, and that I have, that I make decisions based upon what I think is the right thing to do rather than what, other people want me to do.
Fantastic. Now to really wrap up the interview, your reflections on your relationship to God was one of the most well-posited and well-thought-out reflections I've ever seen. Would you mind, just for our Brazilian audience and the Brazilian wider public, which is very much Catholic, your uncle, the 35th president, John F. Kennedy, he was the first Roman Catholic president, and as we know, as Roman Catholicism is so prevalent in Brazil. A quick mention about that?
Because of my own struggle with addiction, the part of overcoming that struggle was developing, what I would say is kind of a conscious contact with my God, and trying not to live my life based upon, addiction is about self-obsession, and it's about living an ego-driven life. And in order to recover, you really have to make a transition and say, I'm going to live for some other purpose. And the way that you do that is by trying to stay in a posture of surrender, of constantly saying, am I doing the thing that God wants me to do right now? And if you're not, then having the discipline to change what you're doing. And if you are, then trying to be content within yourself and trying to be grateful. I try to maintain that posture of surrender. I think most of us think about God when we're in a lot of trouble. And, it's like a foxhole prayer.
Yep.
And addiction put me into that kind of trouble so that, I was willing to say, okay, the way that I'm living my life is not working. I need to let somebody else run my life. But then, when your life starts to get better and the cash and prizes start flowing in, I think all of us have the inclination to say, thank you, God, I got it from here, and then take the wheel of the car and drive it off a cliff again. And the big challenge is staying in that posture of surrender, even when everything's going well, and connecting into that higher power and letting providence steer your life rather than ego.
Thank you so much, Secretary Kennedy.
Right. It's an honor.
Thank you.
So that's Robert Kennedy Jr., interviewed by Voz's Doc Podder, and talking about he finishes off with faith. My God. So not God, but my God. Maybe he's not quite as strong a Roman Catholic as his uncle. Anyway, now we're going to be hearing a bit more about Tommy. It's about what's going on. How is Tommy being projected around the world? Well, of course, it's the mainstream press, but it's also social media. And how was it the death threats were transmitted? Tommy Robinson's own little YouTube channel, the Rebel News people. So I thought I'd have a longer chat about all of this and how is it that we've gone to social media trying to get away from the mainstream media, but the mainstream media is bad, but also social media is being colonised. Don DeBar from New York talked to me earlier this week, and the full version will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk about techno-feudalism.
I remember Kurt Vonnegut wrote years ago, I don't remember which book, it was just a passage really, but the image stuck with me. Earth was jazzed with electricity for a while, describing basically human evolution up to and including the modern age, and which last for a very short time, and then we're back to rolling rocks around and you know, trying to find some bison or whatever. The internet is here. It has evolved to both. You know, you've got the infrastructure itself. You know, the physical, informational, you know, programming and software, whatever, all that stuff that operates, and the operating systems and the platforms and whatnot. Most of the equipment that houses most of the data is privately owned. The ownership of that data is in a state of flux still, but there's been a very strong movement. You know, property rights in the United States and in England, you know, in Britain and in a number of other European countries had. I mean, you can see a line of evolution, and there's some branches in it from Rome, and it's not really a lot of, there are a couple, but not a lot of big sea changes in terms of concept. Certainly, the idea of a public square of a public what do you call it? Public spaces. I forget the hell the damn word is for it. has shrunken. You know, the public trust, the public domain that was considered mostly everything except for what the king and some rich guys owned, and then where, you know, the rest, everybody else was on public land, which, of course, since the king owned the public or some regent owned the public, they had that kind. Anyway, property rights have evolved, and this is an area of my expertise. I spent 50 years probably in the title insurance business here, which is land titles, ownership of real estate. The intellectual property rights, such as copyright and trademark and all of that, were at different points in time, whether different rapid changes of technology, you would see some accompanying changes in legal thinking and practice and in cases interpreting laws that, you know, were older but reinterpreting them to sort of accommodate to the new environment, whatever. But nothing like we've seen. You know, for example, the movie It's a Wonderful Life, Jimmy Stewart and Bedford Falls. They have, you know, that was in the public domain along with a lot of other stuff up until, I don't know, 5-10 years ago, and they suddenly are not. Some corporation owns them, and so you don't have access to these things. The reason I'm bringing this up is the internet was like a Wild West when it first was connected. People, if you had some technological skills or technician's skills, you could capture, like record a record off the record that you bought at the store for $3 10 years ago, and put it on a website or send it around by email and mass distribute it. And no one could really do anything about it. And then Congress and everybody started having hearings because the owners of the, under the old paradigm, you know, were basically, and even the people who owned or thought they owned the copyrights to all this music, that they insisted that the manufacturers stop making this equipment that was accessible to the public, unless they could safeguard against their property being converted to, you know, by members of the public and shared without them getting a piece of it. And there's ASCAP. I don't know if you're familiar with ASCAP or BMI or these different entities that for years, I write a song, I have publishing rights to it, somebody records it, they have recording rights to it, and then somebody plays it on the radio and they're selling advertising space on their radio show while they play my music. Well, I'm supposed to get paid. I'm not. This is mine. I own it, and I copyright it. They file with the, you know, government office, and the government says, "Yeah, you're the owner of this." The song itself, or this recording of the song, this, you know, performance of the song, whatever. After a time, and this was for copyright, also for patents, intellectual property, for inventions and whatever, you would have exclusive right to something that, you know, that you could go to court and enforce for a period of time, 7 years, 20 years, whatever, understanding that human innovation ultimately belongs to all of humanity. That because some guy invented the wheel 200,000 years ago, his heir shouldn't be sitting on top of half of the land on the planet while the rest of us have to bob offshore because we were born after this guy invented the wheel. And so after a period of time of getting to live off the fat of the land, the wheel now belongs to everybody. Next innovation, please. Well, they started undoing that stuff. And once they secured or began to secure control, they meaning I don't know who, power, capital. Once they began to secure absolute control, or pretty damn close to it, of the traffic on the internet by a variety of ways, they also began acquiring property rights and all these things. Now, the ironic part of it is that the very existence of Google, as one example, is entirely based on their providing information about stuff other people owned and or innovated and or did. They were nothing more than an index to what information was available on the internet. And so if I wrote a paper dissecting, I don't know, mice, for example, genetically, that detailed all these little things that were innovations, and even if I had copyrighted it or whatever I did, if I published it, Google could put it in somebody else's lap without paying me a dime all over the world, and to an extent unprecedented, almost geometrically. And as they began to acquire control of more and more things, they began to claim property and all of these things that belong to other people. And they began to favor this one as against that one for money. You understand, you can buy ranking at Google when it says sponsored on the top. And I don't think you're going to have to put that much longer. And I'm not sure everything that doesn't say sponsored isn't placed because of a fee either. But the control of what's, in essence, humanity's memory and humanity's conscious mind and then humanity's eyes and ears is concentrated in a way that was unimaginable even 20 or 30 years ago. I mean, okay, maybe Zamyatin imagined it, you know, 100 years ago, you know, or – you know, Orwell or whomever. But and just in terms of, I mean, I marvel at driving in my car with a GPS. I make a turn. The GPS tells me to make a left turn and I go straight. I'm not 10 feet past that. And it's recalculating a route. It knows the names of all the streets. It knows where I am. It adjusts its estimate of my arrival based on how fast I'm going at the moment. And if it was doing that for me, I'd say, wow, that's remarkable. They could use that for a cruise missile, which is what they developed it for. But you got millions and millions of people all over the planet doing that, and this system is processing all of that too. This has never existed before. This entire infrastructure has never existed before, and now they're taking this step or have taken this step, and we're learning that they've taken the step of letting it operate itself in a lot of ways. A frightening level.
of but what you're describing is, it seems to me, is a way to prohibit innovation. If you're not going to get the reward, I mean, I can remember probably around about 2000, singer songwriter Peter Gabriel saying exactly this, saying, "Well, look, you know, if we can no longer control, you know, this industry is going to die," and it basically has died. For people who are musicians, they have really the only way, as I know you are too, the only way to really make it these days is if you get yourself a massive concert tour, if you get picked up by one of the big distributors of online music downloads, that sort of thing. But the main thing is actually getting on a big stage in front of a big audience, then you can make a few bob. Other than that, you get some brilliant musicians around, but there is no system that rewards what they're doing in the way that things used to happen. So in a way, what it's doing is it's just saying, well, just forget this. This is just going to be a hobby for you, even if you're one of the best musicians in the world. You may as well just go and work down the local burger bar.
Yeah. You know, go downtown, wherever you are, with a pad, make a list of every shop that you see, what they do. Go home or just sit on a bench somewhere with your little handheld and go to Amazon and, you know, look at, candy canes, strawberry cake, Fender for a 1956 Chevy, guitar, et cetera. Whatever it is that you see there, think about how many people are not going to any of these shops anymore. I mean, the whole political economy has changed. The whole economic infrastructure is based on what came before, and it's a child and a product of what came before. But it seems to be also like standing above it and not upon it. It's something very new, and yet there's this dialectical aspect to it in that what looks to me, I mean, for what I know, whatever the hell I know, it looks to me like they're using it at the end of the day when this is fully expressed, if that's allowed to happen, you're going to have an updated, technologically capable form of feudalism. Everything will be owned by a small group, of people, I guess, or I don't know, maybe the machines will own it, but yeah, a small group of people. The rest of us that are remain, we don't really have any control over resource allocation. We would be relying on the benevolence or beneficence of whoever is in charge of resource allocation. If they decide to manage the population from one to, small, I mean, there are all these paranoid, I would say paranoid psychotic, but paranoid theories about what's happening, and yet it corresponds so closely to reality that it's difficult to dismiss them out of hand or even to dismiss them at all. But I know the potential is there for some really ugly developments, even beyond the kind of ugly developments we have now, where we're watching an actual Holocaust happen and nobody's lifting a finger about it. They're pointing fingers at each other, over stupid stuff. The kind of world that could come out of where we are now is one where life is absolutely worthless. No one will have any control at all. Not even, we used to hear back in the day about totalitarian Soviet Russia, but that because that system didn't work, they had to let farmers grow their own little plot, and that's what they made truck farms, stuff runs to the city and stuff with. They won't even have that. We won't even have the, quarter acre to grow tomatoes on or whatever. All of the resources are being concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. The power to govern that is actually owned by that power. I mean, we look at the government now, at the relationship of the government to wealth, finance, whatever. It's clear that power doesn't reside in the halls of government. I guess I have to put it that way.
That's Don DeBar speaking to me earlier this week about some of the innovations that there have been in communications. So we had this sort of golden age of film, we've had the golden age of television, we've had the golden age of the internet, and one by one they've all been shut down. I suppose maybe now internet is being too. It certainly isn't delivering the goods that it possibly could do if it hadn't been dominated by these tech giants. Anyway, thanks very much, Don, for that. A full version of that up on our show page, about an hour and 20 minutes long, at thisweek.org.uk. Later tonight. So, time for a break.
Kitty Wells was one of the few country stars that was actually born in Music City. She was born in Nashville, Tennessee, in 1918. She met her future husband, Johnny Wright, Mr. Wright, of Johnny and Jack, and it was him who gave her the stage name, taken from an old folk ballad called I'm a Gonna Marry Kitty Wells. She began touring as part of Johnny and Jack's show and had a number of hits on her own. In 1974, she was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame, deservedly so. She sings a song here about a vengeful God who will set your fields on fire.
There's a call that rings for the one who sings to those now gone astray. Saying, come ye men, and your load of sin there at the altar lay. You don't seem to heed at the chain of greed, your conscience never tires. Be assured, my friend, if you still offend, he will set your fields on fire. If you don't from sin retire, he will set your fields on fire. You have heard Jesus call, and in death your soul must fall. Now, my friends, if you desire, you may join the heavenly choir and rejoice with him, free from every sin, when he sets this world on fire. You have heard his voice, seen the souls rejoice that trusted in his grace. You have blessed with sin, and he knocked with, but still you hide your face from the blessed Lord and his own true word. But still you say retire, leave the downward path, kindle not his wrath, or he'll set your fields on fire. If you don't from sin retire, he will set your fields on fire. You have heard fall, and in death your soul must fall. Now, my friends, if you desire, you may join the heavenly choir and rejoice with him, free from every sin, when he sets this world on fire.
That was Kitty Wells singing He Will Set Your Fields on Fire.
In a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning on a never spinning reel, like a snowball down a mountain or a carnival balloon, like a carousel that's turning, running rings around the moon, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face, and the world is like an apple whirling silently in space, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind, like a tunnel that you follow to a tunnel of its own, down a hollow to a cavern where the sun has never shone, like a door that keeps revolving in a half-forgotten dream, or the ripples from a pebble someone tosses in a stream, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face, and the world is like an apple whirling silently in space, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind. Keys that jingle in your pocket, words that jangle in your head. Why did summer go so quickly? Was it something that you said? Lovers walk along the shore and leave their footprints in the sand. Is the sound of distant drumming just the fingers of your hand? Pictures hanging in a hallway and the fragment of a song. I've remembered names and faces, but to whom do they belong? When you knew that it was over, you were suddenly aware that the autumn leaves were turning to the colour of our hair. A circle in a spiral, a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning on an ever-spinning wheel, as the images unwind like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind.
Wiles, Set Your Fields on Fire, with good old Bob Dylan and his Theme Time Radio Hour. Track them down, folks. It's brilliant. Never, of course, on the... Well, maybe it was on the BBC at 3 o'clock in the morning or something. That's what they do, isn't it? The song Fields on Fire by Kitty Wiles is from 1974. Then we heard Stanley Kirby with Windmills of Your Mind, and Kate Bush, The Man with the Child in His Eyes, from 1978. So a bit of 68 with Windmills of Your Mind and 78 with Kate Bush. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with me, Tony Gosling. Martin back next week with a live show. But anyhow, let's get cracking with Gaza, because the most mind-blowing, brilliant speech was given this week by Ilan Volkov. He was an Israeli composer at the proms, not at the last night, which was an absolute travesty and mess. And here he is explaining, I mean, this is in a way the biggest round of applause of the whole proms, is when an Israeli composer gets up in front of everyone and says, we, meaning he, the Israelis and the Palestinians, cannot stop the genocide, please help us. What an amazing, brilliant and beautiful appeal to make at the Royal Albert Hall as part of the BBC proms.
Thank you so much, all of you, for sharing this amazing music together with us. It's a real privilege to be here every year with my friends, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. In my heart, there is great pain now, every day, for months. I come from Israel and live there. I love it. It's my home. But what's happening now is atrocious and horrific in a scale that I'm not used to. I know that many, it's okay, you can go if you don't want politics. Politics is part of life, every yes. day. Every day. Yes. I know that many of us feel completely hopeless in front of this. Innocent Palestinians being killed in thousands. Displaced again and again, without hospitals, without schools. Not knowing when the next meal is. Israeli hostages are kept in inhuman conditions for 2 years. For 2 years. And political prisoners are languishing in Israeli jails. Israelis, Jews and Palestinians. Israelis, Jews and Palestinians. You will let me finish and then you can curse me all your life. No problem. No problem. Israelis, Jews and Palestinians, we are not able to stop this alone. I ask you, I beg you, all to do whatever is in your power to stop this madness. Every little action counts while governments hesitate and wait. We cannot let this go on any longer. Every moment that passes puts the safety of millions at risk. Thank you. Thank you.
Volkov there, Israeli composer, explaining that the Palestinians and the Israelis cannot stop the genocide. Please, world, will you help us? And the BBC have been looking, I mean, it's falling apart, isn't it? Israel's propaganda wars just destroy. I mean, the actual war carries on, obviously. There needs to be some armed people in there protecting the Gazans. But the propaganda war, the BBC even this week, putting out BBC Verify, saying that, coming down completely on the side of the Palestinians and the rest of the world and not on the side of the Israelis.
Professor Ralph Wild is based at University College London. He represented the states of the Arab League at the International Court of Justice in proceedings relating to Israel and Palestinian territories. And he argues that Gaza's status before the 7th of October is relevant to whether the right to self-defense applies.
Israel's use of force after October the 7th, 2023 was not a new use of force. It was a continuation of that pre-existing use of force, amplifying it to an extreme level. It was therefore a continuation of an illegal use of force.
Israel rejects such an argument. And there's a second reason why some say the right to self-defense doesn't apply. Francesca Albanese argues that this right only applies if an attack comes from another state. Some of the international law experts we spoke to disagree. Lord Sumption told us such a position is barely arguable. Professor Emily Crawford told us since the 9/11 attacks, many states have been prepared to accept that the right to self-defense under international law extends to uses of force against the state by non-state actors. An Israeli academic, Professor Yuval Shani, told us Israel did have a right to self-defense following the October the 7th attack by virtue of the state-like features of Hamas-controlled Gaza. This debate is relevant to whether Israel's overall response can be considered a proportionate act of self-defense. Though Professor Jerry Simpson adds, even if Israel has a right to self-defense, the exercise of it has been disproportionate. And then there's Professor Asa Kasher, who told us the right to self-defense continues to apply for as long as Hamas poses a threat to Israel and its population. And he adds, self-defense is well justified, as long as the goal is defense. Whether it is the goal, though, is contested. Israel's finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, said in May that his country's goal was destroying everything that's left of the Gaza Strip. He also talked of conquering, cleansing, and remaining in Gaza until Hamas is destroyed. In July, according to Israeli media, the Israeli defense minister proposed resettling the entire Palestinian population of Gaza at a camp in the south of the territory. The UN had previously warned that the forcible transfer of an occupied territory's civilian population is tantamount to ethnic cleansing. The proposed humanitarian city was discussed by the Israeli cabinet, but no plans to move forward have been made public. But Israeli statements, proposals, and actions are causing some to question whether its goals and its actions go beyond self-defense.
This is not a war where the goal is defeat, it is a war where the goal is destruction.
Professor Jerry Simpson told us the Israeli response looks more like revenge or the continuation of a long-running erasure of Palestinian identity than anything one could call legitimate self-defense. Israel rejects any such suggestion. And Sir Geoffrey Nice KC told us this.
It has become increasingly hard to accept that these stated military objectives that justify the really very widespread and wholesale killing of innocent civilians can be bona fide.
Professor Yinin Adil also queries Israel's aims.
We can look at Israel's conduct as potentially pursuing a legitimate defensive aim, which is to incapacitate Hamas to a point where it can't launch another October the 7th. But if we listen to Israeli security forces and Israeli decision makers, we must understand that this is not anymore or predominantly the aim Israel is pursuing in Gaza.
Israel rejects any such suggestions. The IDF told BBC Verify the terrorist organizations in the Gaza Strip systematically violate international law and deliberately carry out military operations from within the civilian population. The IDF will continue to operate against the terrorist organizations in the Gaza Strip whenever and wherever necessary. International justice often deals in years and decades, not weeks and months. There are limitations on what it can do during and after a conflict. However, in time, the institutions that apply international law, such as the International Court of Justice, can and do draw definitive conclusions. These rulings matter, as do the laws themselves. However imperfect, they are the rules that most countries have agreed should define what they can and can't do. As such, they count for a lot. The vast majority of the experts we spoke to believe that all or some aspect of Israel's actions have not been proportionate, in particular with regards to its overall operation. They reached that conclusion for different reasons and with differing degrees of certainty. Professor Asakasher has concluded that it is reasonable to assume that some of Israel's actions have failed proportionality standards. Professor Neve Gordon told us this.
It is, to me, obvious that Israel's carrying out war crimes and crimes against humanity because it is breaching daily the principle of proportionality.
Professor Yuval Shani says the continuation of the military campaign can no longer be seen as proportionate. And Professor Daviga Hovel calls it grossly disproportionate. Meanwhile, the conflict continues. A much diminished Hamas is still fighting, still holding hostages, still denying Israel's right to exist. Israel insists it followed international law throughout this conflict and that its actions are proportionate. But nearly all of the experts we spoke to aren't convinced.
So that's BBC Verify taking a good look at proportionality in Israel's war on Gaza. Nice to see the BBC doing the right thing, but then, you know, a little bit late maybe, two years late maybe. So getting back to Gaza and Charlie Kirk now, Max Blumenthal has this time last week was publishing the information that there were certain individuals that threatened Charlie Kirk, people who'd been giving him money, saying, look, you know, we own you basically, and what, you know, anyway, so this is obviously one of the massive motives for murder. Netanyahu and the Israel lobby, spoken about here by Max Blumenthal. I think this is on Judge Neapolitano's show.
Following my September 12th report, which provided background about the pressure, the mounting pressure that Charlie Kirk was under from pro-Israel forces, from Netanyahu's cutouts in the United States, I gathered more details. The piece, it hit like a sledgehammer. It really caused a lot of, I think it spoke for a lot of people, particularly within the conservative movement, which is changing among the youth on the question of Israel. And more people started coming out and more people started talking. And people were talking to me, and these were people who had knowledge of a tumultuous, stormy meeting held in the Hamptons during the first week of August, convened, according to multiple sources, with knowledge of this meeting, intimate knowledge of this meeting, by the billionaire ultra-Zionist financier Bill Ackman, who's close to Netanyahu and his kind of network in the United States. Charlie Kirk was summoned along with an array of young, sort of vapid, very avaricious conservative influencers who seemed to be sort of in Israel's back pocket to set a very pro-Israel tone for this meeting. And Charlie Kirk was, according to one source, hammered by Ackman and others for allowing Israel critics, very prominent conservative voices, like Megyn Kelly, Tucker Carlson, or the anti-Zionist Jewish comedian Dave Smith, to appear at his events. And actually, Charlie Kirk was planning to host many of these same figures again in December, and he had just added to his TPUSA major, I think it's called America Fest in December, the premier critic of Israel in Congress. I didn't say Republican critic. I just said premier critic because that's what she is now, Marjorie Taylor Greene, which really reflected his shifting views. And Ackman, according to multiple sources, had this meeting to basically bully Charlie Kirk into submission. Charlie Kirk walked away, according to one person, feeling like there was an attempt to blackmail him. He refused any offers of funding and also refused the offer to travel to Israel and meet with Netanyahu, which Netanyahu disclosed in the wake, the immediate wake of Netanyahu's death. He talked about this letter, but he didn't say whether Charlie Kirk refused or accepted. I've learned since that he refused. And then beyond that, he was becoming so alienated by this crowd of pro-Israel enforcers, that he was moving away from the Protestant church. This is what I've been told. Candace Owens just disclosed this on her live stream. And, you know, he was a Protestant who, as a young conservative voice, and, you know, I believe an evangelical Christian.
He was a Christian nationalist by his own words.
Yes. And he was pushing the idea of this Judeo-Christian alliance. And that was like music to the ears of the pro-Israel funders. But now he was starting to attend Catholic Mass with his wife, Erica, and moving in a different direction, what Candace Owens called a spiritual transformation. And the Catholics just don't have that same conceptualization of American Christian nationalism and the Judeo-Christian alliance.
Correct.
This has never been, I don't think it's been reported before. So he was undergoing a transformation, a singular figure in the Trump world, unreplaceable, sort of a unique figure in that world. And he was moving on this question, and there really wasn't anything they could do to stop him, because you couldn't just, I mean, I'm sure there would have been an attempt, and there already was, through figures like Ben Shapiro and Mark Levin at Fox News, to attack him and sort of suggest maybe he should be removed. But you can't really just remove someone like that who's built this entire gigantic infrastructure around himself. So we really don't know where things would have gone, but these two stories together, I think, paint a picture of it's a wider history of where the conservative movement itself is going, and the kind of the astroturfing from pro-Israel 1%ers to prevent that.
This will undermine Trump's support on this issue substantially. So his good buddy, the Vice President of the United States, is a Catholic convert. Candace Owens is a Catholic convert. Mrs. Kirk is a born and raised Roman Catholic. This probably terrified the Christian nationalists, the Mike Huckabee types, and their wealthy American, mainly New York, Zionist financiers. Do we know from your sources what Kirk himself thought of Netanyahu? Did he feel intimidated by Netanyahu?
Yes, absolutely. And I think the reason that people initially started talking to me was that Netanyahu came out while Charlie Kirk's body was still warm and started lying about him and trying to recast him as his best friend. Now, it's true. Right. Charlie Kirk was, until fairly recently, certainly before October 7th, 2023, the most important Gentile asset that Israel might have had today. Possibly more important than Trump, because Charlie Kirk was preaching the pro-Israel gospel to young people, and he was potentially on his way to becoming president or senator, someone very important to Israel. So he, as soon as he starts to make some noises after October 7th about Israel's misdeeds, but particularly about Israel's malign influence in Washington, and then he experienced the pressure from pro-Israel donors like Bill Ackman, Netanyahu enters the picture. And Charlie Kirk, according to a longtime friend of his, who I spoke to, considered Netanyahu a disgusting bully who was a manipulator and was fundamentally dishonest. And this stands at complete odds with the picture Netanyahu has tried to paint in not just one, but I think five or maybe six tweets since Charlie Kirk was killed. And additionally, I mean, I think it's important to recognize what Netanyahu was doing. He was trying to do the same thing he did after 9/11, when the Israeli publication Ma'ariv reported in 2008 that Netanyahu said 9/11 is good for Israel. And he thought that he wanted to exploit Charlie Kirk's killing in a way that benefited Israel by pushing a narrative of religious warfare and Islamophobia inside the U.S. And he blamed Islam and radical Muslims and the left for killing Charlie Kirk before the suspect was even known, before anyone had even been caught. And so the truth and the reality about Charlie Kirk's relationship with Netanyahu turns Netanyahu's whole sectarian militaristic narrative on its head.
The Grey Zone's Max Blumenthal there, one of the greatest journalists out there at the moment. With I think of the Grey Zone as a sort of US version of Declassified UK, really. And they're doing the best journalism in the world, as far as I can see. Well, you know, at least that's the sort of stuff that those people at Windsor Castle should be listening to. So that is, yes, Max Blumenthal talking about the Israel lobby's role in bullying and threatening Charlie Kirk before he was assassinated. I think it's interesting to get the take of somebody like Scott Ritter on this, former UN weapons inspector, because Judge Knapp asks him about Netanyahu going on TV to deny assassinating Charlie Kirk, an extraordinary thing to do.
Why do you think Benjamin Netanyahu had to go on international television before this person, Tyler Robinson, was even caught or identified and deny that the Israelis had murdered Kirk?
I can't. It's the kind of behavior that guilty people do, or people who are worried. I think Israel's got a PR problem right now in the United States, a huge PR problem. And I think that, this drives a lot of what Israel's doing. Whether or not Israel had anything to do with Charlie Kirk's murder, we should point out there's no evidence of that whatsoever. I mean, there's circumstantial conspiracy laden theories out there, but there's no direct evidence that Israel played any role in Charlie Kirk's murder. But the fact of the matter is the internet is alive with buzz about a Charlie Kirk Israel connection. Israel right now is facing from their perspective, a very dangerous sway in public opinion here in the United States against Israel. President Trump has even commented on that. And I think that this was an effort by a desperate prime minister to do damage control. I think it failed. I mean, as you pointed out, it makes him look even more guilty. But I think Israel right now is in dire straits because of the ongoing genocide in Gaza and the heavy impact that's had on Israel's reputation. And they're very concerned about American public opinion right now. And, right now there's it's a trend on online that Israel was behind Charlie Kirk's assassination.
Before we leave Charlie Kirk, Max Blumenthal has reported about the extraordinary pressure that AIPAC put on Charlie Kirk by first offering him an enormous amount of money to fund his outfit, and then when he turned them down, pressuring him. And Max reports that obviously before he was killed, Kirk told one of his colleagues that he couldn't stand Netanyahu and that Netanyahu was behind the pressure being put on him. Kirk, who once supported the United States' support of Israel, no matter what Israel did, apparently in the past 2 years was making a slow migration to the view of recognizing this as genocide, and Netanyahu was not happy with it, and Kirk recognized that and didn't want to have anything to do with him. Does any of this surprise you?
Again, I'm going to just be straight up honest, Judge. Prior to Charlie Kirk's assassination, he didn't register in my life at all. He is not a player in international geopolitics. He doesn't have any impact on military affairs or any of the work that I was doing. He is an influencer with great importance, and I can understand how Israel, concerned about public relations, would be worried of an influencer who, was once very pro-Israel suddenly moving in the other direction. But I'm new to the Charlie Kirk game. It's not a game I want to be involved in. I've talked about free speech and how his murder is an affront to free speech. I believe Charlie Kirk had every right to say what he was saying, even if people disagreed with him. But, it doesn't surprise me that AIPAC, seeks to put pressure on and influence people or try to bribe them. I, at one time, was offered a $6 million bribe by AIPAC back in the good old days of Paul Wolfowitz and company. And I turned it down, and the rest is history. But it's what they do for a living, and it doesn't surprise me that Charlie Kirk, a man who influenced millions of Americans and had taken a very strong stance pro-Israel, that any gravitation away from that would be something that would get on Israel's radar. What does surprise me is the direct involvement of Benjamin Netanyahu, and what that reeks of is desperation, that Israel's actually in an absolute state of panic about what's happening to them globally. They are being isolated. Netanyahu acknowledged it. He said, we're going to have to learn how to be self-sufficient economically. I laughed because Israel will never be self-sufficient. They'll always live off the largesse of the American taxpayer.
That's former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter denying, commenting on Netanyahu denying assassinating Charlie Kirk. Well, how about that? Never believe anything until it's been officially denied. Also, Charlie, I think we have to understand, Charlie was part of a movement, a pro-life movement. For many people, don't necessarily understand how big this is in the United States. It's called Students for Life. And here is an interview with Kristen Hawkins, who runs Students for Life, which is one of the pro-life, that is, anti-abortion organisations that Charlie Kirk was working with. And I can remember going down to the Boscastle Museum of Witchcraft a few years ago, and they have a whole section on Satanism there. And it says, there it is right in front of your face, one of the main objects of Satanists is abortion. They love it. And I suppose this is connected with child sacrifice in some way. The only other thing that they said that they really like is infiltrating and taking over churches. So, you know, maybe that's, who knows if that's true or not. But anyway, let's have a listen to Kristen Hawkins, Students for Life, talking about the life of Charlie Kirk and his influence.
Is it a human being in the womb? Yes or no? Yes. Well, then why don't you give the human being rights?
Well, that's what I'm trying to just...
No, ask the question. There will be a woman that sees us that's contemplating an abortion right now.
Yeah, and I pray that she doesn't do it.
And I hope she takes a pause, and I'm going to be very honest with you. The next 9 months will be hard. Your body will change. You're going to go through mood swings, and then it's not going to get much easier once the baby comes in. But it is worth it beyond anything I can put into words. DNA does not start in 6 weeks or 8 weeks or 10 weeks or 20 weeks. It starts at conception. And that's when you were formed. That's when you came into this world. And is what species is the fetus?
The fetus is not a species yet. It's technically classified as a parasite until it is viable.
So,
no, I want to talk to you about something very quickly.
I can't really get past that. Are you saying a baby is a disease or a tumor? You just talked about sex selective abortion is Nazi eugenics philosophy, which is that we will eliminate those that we don't want.
Interesting. You're exactly right. You did get me on that one.
I love that moment. Well, Charlie Kirk was a devoted father and a tireless advocate for the pro-life movement, using his platform to speak with courage and compassion for every human life. So how can we build upon that work that Charlie did? Well, here to discuss is Kristen Hawkins, the president of Students for Life of America. Through her organization, Kristen, you do a lot of the same work, just sort of compassionately arguing and persuading on the side of life. And what's fascinating with Charlie and with your work is that you can actually persuade people if you give them the facts.
That's absolutely right, Rachel. And I think what you saw in those videos is Charlie not only planting seeds of truth in the minds of those who were brave enough to talk to him, but also the entire audience. And that audience was in person, but then also millions online. And that's what we see every day. I mean, the comments that have been coming in online since Charlie's assassination, people writing to me personally saying, I used to be pro-choice, and then I saw a video of you, I saw a video of Charlie, and I knew I could no longer be associated with that. Comments from young people who've come in by the hundreds to Students for Life saying, what more can I do? I know I've always been pro-life, but I was always afraid. But with what happened with Charlie, I know I can no longer be silent about this. And yeah. So I think what we're seeing, Rachel, is God, you know, taking this horrific tragedy, and we're seeing young people rise up. And I think Charlie is very excited about that, looking down from heaven.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Listen, I wanted to do this segment because I was moved by how compassionately he dealt with it. And it's a tricky subject, right? Because a lot of the women in the audience have had abortions. Chemical abortions are very easy to do. That's kind of how I learned through a conversation that Charlie was having with a young woman that so many young college girls were having these abortions in their dorm rooms. They didn't know what they were doing. They were lied to. The fact that he was so effective in such an emotionally charged environment, I just think speaks to just how much compassion and love he had in him.
That's right. You know, and when Charlie goes to campuses, when I go to campuses, I was on campus when Charlie was assassinated. What we're doing is we're bringing the truth and we're bringing reason, and it's with compassion. And because it's Sunday, I wanted to share this quote from Pope Benedict. He said, "When reason is abandoned, violence becomes the only remaining path." Mm-hmm. And I think that's the challenge before us now, where can we go and continue to exercise our First Amendment rights on college campuses, bringing reason, bringing truth with love and compassion, as Charlie did so, so effectively?
Yeah.
Or do we allow the violence to rule the day?
Yeah. Well, I really am glad, sad that Charlie's not there to shine that light on campuses that never, ever in the classroom. That's right. Value this point of view, but I'm really glad that you're still in the fight. You are wicked smart. I've seen you debate and persuade myself, and you do it every day on campus with Students for Life. And so I love that you're honoring him by continuing your work. Kristen Hawkins, Students for Life, thank you.
Thank you, Rachel.
So that was Kristen Hawkins at Students for Life in the United States, talking about Charlie Kirk, honouring Charlie Kirk's contribution to the pro-life fight against abortion. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest, Don DeBar. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips on the Tony Gosling Censored Telegram channel and via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, which includes the podcast, full-length interviews, story links and comment page. Subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. And if you can afford it, do please donate or even set up a small monthly sub at thisweekoneword.org.uk. You can sometimes find me at places like the Richie Allen Show, and Reality Check Radio. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. My paperbacks, firstly about deals between Churchill and the Nazis at the end of World War II, The Traitors of Arnhem, that's Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group, costs 15 quid. All my secret government anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana assassination, The Siege of Heaven Reader, they're both on eBay, and you'll find the Siege of Heaven ebook with my RT articles plus my most recent on John Dee and the Empire at www.bilderberg.org. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11:05 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream. So do please make live recordings. So we've been on the stream at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream this show live or rebroadcast it, let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend, and do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
I really love you. You'll never know how much I really care. Listen, do you want to know a secret? Do you promise not to tell? Whoa, whoa, closer. Let me whisper in your ear. Say the words you long to hear. I'm in love with you. Ooh. Listen.
want to know a secret? Do you promise not to tell? Whoa, whoa, closer. Let me whisper in your ear. Say the words you long to hear. I'm in love with you. I've known a secret for a week or two. Nobody knows, just we two. Listen, do you want to know a secret? Do you promise not to tell?
The friendship's built on trust, and that's something you never do. Well, who knows, maybe tomorrow we can share each other's sorrows and compare our graveside manner as we wave our lonely banners. If you ever think of me, I'll be thinking of you. Decide to change your view, I'm thinking of you. You can walk away from loneliness anytime you choose.
And you're the sort of person that hasn't anything to lose.
But who cares, maybe tomorrow you can lead and I could follow. So walk where angels fear to tread, for everything you've ever wanted. And if you ever think of me, I'll be thinking of you. If you can spare an hour or two, you'll know what to do. I could be the one thing there in your hour of need. So if you decide to change your views, I'm thinking of you. Let's roll the dice in a fool's paradise. Share moonlit nights, breathing nothing but lies. Let's open our eyes.
We should take a book to somewhere else, to something new. Thank God we're alive and bite off more than we can chew. Do the things that just don't matter, laugh while others look in anger, stumble over four leaf clovers and say goodbye to lonely banners. If you ever think of me, I'll be thinking of you. Through thick and thin, I bear it and grin. I never give in. I could be the one thing left in your hour of need. So if you decide to change your views, I'm thinking of you.
Thank you.
on the storm, riders on the storm. Into this house we're born, into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone, and packed her out alone. Riders on the storm, there's a killer on the road. His brain is squirming like a toad. Take a long holiday, let your children play. If you give this man, riders on the storm, riders on the storm. Into this house we're born, into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone.